With Ellen Gabriel. Ellen Gabriel is the president of the Quebec Native Women's Association, and she has been active in raising awareness and campaigning on the issue of missing, murdered, and disappeared Native women in Canada and Quebec. Ellen, welcome to No One Is Legal Radio.
Thank you very much, Shaggy.
Ellen, this past weekend there was a search organized near Maniwaki to search for two missing teenage Native women. One of the mothers of one of those missing girls, Lori Ojek, has been quite outspoken about what she sees as a double standard when it comes to missing, murdered, disappeared Natives vis-a-vis the rest of Canadian and Quebec society. Could you speak a bit about the issue that's before us? How many people are we talking about? What are the issues that are being laid out before us as people speak out more and more about this particular issue?
Yeah, well, the Native Women's Association of Canada has been doing a research project called Sisters in Spirit, and they've examined the incidences and cases since 1980 of murdered or missing Aboriginal women in Canada. As of March 31st of this year, they have said that there's 520 cases of murdered and missing Aboriginal women in Canada since 1980. And that there are 126 are missing, 347 are identified as having died as a result of homicide or negligence, and then there's 43 cases where it's the nature of the cases are unconfirmed, and 4 cases of suspicious death. Now, of those cases, we find that the police do not respond, and they are not implementing a protocol. In which, in 2006, the Chiefs of Police Association had said that they would implement a protocol on how to deal with cases of murdered or missing Aboriginal women because of the high incidences. To date, there's no implementation of it. To date, we do not see the press make a concerted effort to help Aboriginal families when their daughter or family member goes missing. And yet we do see many cases of that across Canada, of non-Aboriginal women or children going missing with an Amber Alert, in a sense, going right away. So we see that there's a double standard because there's a stereotype, even with policing authorities, that, oh, well, they're gone partying, you know, or if it's close to Christmas, why don't you wait until Christmas? Maybe they'll come back. And, you know, we still have a sense of community, so we know instinctively when there's something to be alarmed about, if our family member has not arrived. We know about the first case of Helen Betty Osborne, who was raped and killed by several men in Manitoba, and the RCMP knew who the killers were for many, many years, and they were forced to arrest the men. So the judge said at the end of the trial that, you know, had she not been an Aboriginal woman, Helen Betty Osborne would be alive today. And this all stems back to the process of colonization, the devaluation, especially under the Indian Act, of Aboriginal women, and that society tends to look on Aboriginal women as not being worth much. So there's a double standard and a double discrimination against Aboriginal women for those two reasons, being Aboriginal and being a woman.
Ellen, can you break down what that statistic means when we talk about, according to the Native Women's Association of Canada and their Sisters in Spirit campaign, more than 500 missing, murdered, disappeared Native women? Mm-hmm. That's a statistic. And behind each and every person, there's a family, there's loved ones, there's human dignity, there's a person. But break down a bit more for us what that statistic means.
Well, it means that there are families who were not granted justice and still don't have closure to a human rights violation made against a family member. Violence against anybody is a human rights issue, and in particular for Aboriginal women, it's one of the biggest human rights violations of Aboriginal women in Canada. It's really difficult to tell authorities, you know, that this is a human being. But I think the general public can understand if your daughter, if your cousin, if your mother, if your auntie, you know, whoever goes missing, you want to have justice for that. And why is it that we have to make this a lobbying effort to the politicians, to the authorities, to do something about it, to provide equality for Aboriginal women? I think that the political will has been there, but not to the degree that it should be. It's not enough just to provide money for research. There has to be sensitization within the general public and within judges, lawyers, policing authorities to understand that this is a real grave situation that Aboriginal women find themselves in. And so it's really scary for us, you know, for families who have young daughters. We have young nieces who go out there trying to get education in the urban areas and end up being killed or murdered simply by the fact that they're Aboriginal women. This has to be rectified, and you know, Aboriginal women's organizations cannot do this alone. We've been asking many people to step up to the plate, and for some, we're still waiting.
Ellen, can we get more specific about who are the authorities that need to be taking some responsibility and acting on this issue, both within the Native community and also, of course, in non-Native society, which you know has been responsible for hundreds and hundreds of years of dispossession, of genocide, of devaluation, of discrimination, of racism against Native communities. Can you speak about both sides of that equation and who are the people that need to step up and take responsibility for this issue?
Well, I think, you know, given the limited resources we have in our communities of policing, I think we need to get them properly trained. We have made these recommendations time and time again that the police need to be able to be given the tools on how to deal with these particular situations. We need the Aboriginal leadership to also take a more concerted effort in supporting the Aboriginal women's organizations in our cry for help and our concerns that we are losing our sisters to either serial killers or people who are just feel that we're disposable. Because, you know, that's the whole part of colonization. So the Aboriginal leaders, particularly the men, need to get involved because violence against Aboriginal women is not a woman's issue or problem. It's an issue for men and a problem that men have. And so we need the leadership to demonstrate to our young Aboriginal men that they need to respect Aboriginal women and not abuse them. As far as the political will, I think politicians need to stop complaining about how much they spend on Aboriginal people because really 64% of the budget for Aboriginal people goes to the bureaucracy and the Department of Indian Affairs. So there needs to be more sincere political will. We need judges to be able to provide proper sentencing to perpetrators. We need policing authorities to implement their protocol on how to deal with murdered and missing Aboriginal women. We need to have more concerted effort within the educational system to understand what colonization has done and impacted on Aboriginal women and men, because it has impacted on men's ability to protect Aboriginal women. So there needs to be a gender-based approach in examining this issue and how it's tried to take away the power and value of Aboriginal people and in particular Aboriginal women.
Ellen, one approach often to cases of people who are missing, murdered, etc., is to see them as unfortunate incidents. And you've alluded to, and other people involved in this camp have alluded to, sort of having more of a structural analysis of what's going on. And you've talked just now about a gender-based approach. You've used the term colonization and the history of colonization. Could you talk a little bit more about what a decolonization or an anti-colonization gender-based approach and analysis of the situation means and how that will be reflected in our actions and why that's different than simply thinking about more than 500 missing, murdered, and disappeared women as just a statistical blip or something?
Yeah, and it's a good question, because if you look at the realities in our communities, we have a band council system that was designed to support male leadership. It was designed actually to replace the Indian agent. but it was also designed to support male leadership because it comes from a patriarchal culture and it's imposed. So what they did was take away the role of women in decision-making processes. And while there is a small group, a small minority of women who are now within the band council system, it's still not enough because subconsciously we still look at the men as being the decision makers, even within the Indian Act, which everybody has says we have to get rid of. It still devalues Aboriginal women and their ability to pass on their cultural heritage to their children, and you know, it has to do with status. So decolonization would be taking our traditional values and implementing them in practice, in decision-making issues, in how we teach our children, in how our land is used. And it really is about getting rid of the Indian Act because that's the crux of the problem. It created a mentality which is unhealthy, which should no longer be applied in 2009. And, you know, we've been asked, what do you replace it with? Well, I just gave you a good example of what to replace it with. Women deserve to have equality of rights. Most nations in the world have recognized that, and it's still a long, hard struggle. But I think this is what is needed in order for women to gain back their rightful place in the decision-making process, but also to educate within Canadian schools the true history of the Americas and what colonization did and how it targeted Aboriginal women in particular because they knew that we passed on the language, the culture, and heritage of our children. And in some cases, women were the title holders to land. So to target a specific group within on top of targeting a group and then targeting the women, that's genocide. And I think, you know, a lot of these governments in the Americas have to be answerable to it. It's not enough to give an apology. It has to go deeper than words. It has to go through, it has to be evident in actions, and we have yet to see that.
Ellen, I want to talk a little bit about the context within the jurisdiction we know as Quebec. The issue of missing and murdered and disappeared Native women is something I think where there's more awareness on the west coast of Canada, partially as a result of some horrifying action that got a lot of media attention because of the sensationalistic nature of a serial killer and a serial rapist and a serial murderer who targeted Native women. In Quebec, there are a few cases that have been highlighted recently as we raise awareness. There are the cases of Shannon Alexander and Maisie Ojik from the Kitigan-Zibi community near Maniwaki who have been missing since September of last year. There's the case of Tiffany Morrison from Ganawage, just south of Montreal, who's been missing. Could you speak? And there's, of course, cases of murdered young Native of women. In very suspicious circumstances or in circumstances that were not really clear answers. There seems to be a double standard. Could you speak about some of these Quebec cases? What is our terrain here as we strive in the next months and years to build a movement so that there's justice rendered in these cases, true justice that takes into account what you talked about decolonization and about having a gender-based analysis?
Well, I think we need to provide a little bit more mechanisms of support for families who do have missing and murdered family members. You know, in our communities, we tend to rely on services to be the answer. But what colonization has done is has taken away, in the sense that community sense of feeling and support. And so part of that decolonization process is to have everybody say that, you know, if some family member dies then from someone else, I mean, they might not be your immediate family. They're still family. They're still part of all our relations. But we also have to look at the policing authorities and encourage them to open up cold case files. Tiffany Morrison, a Mohawk young woman from Ganawage here, her case was not properly investigated. There are many flaws in how the police responded to it. And so while we can point out the flaws, we can also encourage the police to properly investigate many of these murdered and missing cases like Tiffany's, and to be able to provide some sense of closure for families, because it must be a terrible thing not knowing what has happened to your loved one. And, you know, I've heard of stories of people who have had missing loved ones for 20 years, and they still have hope. And I guess there will always be that hope, but at the same time, I think it's kind of impossible not to think of the worst thing. So we need to provide more support for families. But within society, I think we need to be able to teach our children, everybody's child, about what respect means, what peace means, and I think to value those children when they're growing up, because I'm not too sure what the psyche of a serial killer is made up of, but something has gone horribly wrong. Even those who are not serial killers, but who have taken the lives of other human beings, something has gone horribly wrong for them to do such a thing. So it's within all aspects of society that we need to work on. And, you know, within our own society, we're not perfect. You know, I'm sure we didn't have perfect ancestors, but there was always retribution. There was always something. We didn't have serial killers. I'm sure we didn't have serial killers. And it's only in recent times that we see these kinds of incidences happening in our community. So we see the impact of colonization, and we need to address this within our communities and take responsibility to help educate our children and our youth properly.
Alan, you were involved in a process in your role as a member and president of the Quebec Native Women's Association, where Canada's own record was under examination by, you know, in an international process. Could you talk more about that and how the issue of missing, murdered, and disappeared Native women was addressed within that process?
Yeah, it was a bit of a frustrating process for us all, I think. But it just to note that 7 out of 10 states submitted to the United Nations Universal Periodic Review Council questions about Aboriginal people, and in particular violence against Aboriginal women. And one of the recommendations was for Canada to study and address the root causes of violence against women, in particular Aboriginal women, and to institute a comprehensive reporting and statistical analysis of the scale and character of violence against Indigenous women. And this just goes on and on. They talk about how to end violence and domestic violence, to make domestic violence a criminal offense. You know, there's countries like Germany, New Zealand, Slovenia, Sweden, all kinds of countries are talking about the rights of Indigenous peoples and why Canada does not support the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The international community, I think, is one of the key pressure points for us to put on Canada to respect and not only its duty to consult, but in the honor of the crown. We look at the root causes, which we've talked about. These are recommendations that the international community is making to Canada. Canada has to submit its report by June 3rd to see whether or not, you know, the response to these recommendations. The process I went through, there's no guarantees that all our discussions and recommendations would be even entered into the report, because at the end of the day, it's the Minister of Indian Affairs and other ministers who will approve the reports. What I think is really important to note is that every single state that viewed or reviewed Canada mentioned Indigenous people. And I think that says a lot. I think that's cause for concerns for Canadians, that an international body and community knows more about the situation of Aboriginal people in Canada than most Canadians, and that we have groups like Amnesty International who have been working on this for a long time. Why don't Canadians know enough about it? Why aren't more people concerned? And there's a quote, there's a famous quote made by Martin Luther King, which I always like to bring to light is that an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. And it seems that in the Americas, it doesn't seem to be applicable to indigenous people. We are always the forgotten peoples. And I think it's time to change that. I think it's time that Canadians take a more alert, become more open, more sensitized, and be more aware of not just the situation that Indigenous people in Canada face, but how their government reacts and treats Aboriginal people. And members of civil society that attended it, these consultations conducted by Canadian Heritage, said it's interesting the difference between the Civil Society Day that was dedicated and the day for Aboriginal people, in that the bureaucrats were so condescending to Aboriginal people that the bureaucrats decided to say, well, let's put the Canadian Constitution aside because these are not human rights issues. And Paul Joff, who is a lawyer for the Grand Council of the Cree, said, how can you put the Canadian Constitution aside? That is the basis for what your country goes by and stands by. And you would never presume to say that to any other group in Canada. So I think it's really interesting that it's not just the political will, it's the bureaucrats who also defy Canada's constitutional obligations to Aboriginal people. And that Canadians should know that, you know, why do we do barricades? Because we're frustrated. It seems to be the only way that the Canadian government understands and will take notice of our issues. And we shouldn't have to be doing that. We shouldn't have to be going to the international community to get our rights recognized. Why can't the government of Canada do that?
Ellen, various members of so-called civil society have addressed this issue in different ways and have made recommendations. Could you talk a bit about what are the demands being made by those various groups, including the Native Women's Association of Canada, the Quebec Native Women's Association, the Sisters in Spirit campaign, and groups such as Amnesty and others? What are the tangible demands that are being made in light of what we know about this case, about these cases?
Well, there's many, many recommendations. I think it's interesting to note that everybody seems to be in consensus with the fact that violence is a prevailing issue, not just for Aboriginal people, but society in general. But if we look deeper into the issue, Aboriginal women are the most marginalized within that issue of violence. And so that there needs to be more efforts by government. But if we go to the root causes, and we've been saying that for a long time, let's look at the root causes. Let's look at what residential schools actually did and the policies of forced assimilation against Aboriginal people. It's caused systemic impoverishment, the marginalization of Indigenous women. There are deep-rooted attitudes of racism and sexism that prevail within Canadian society. And this is even extended to lawyers, police, judges, and politicians, as we can see in the Government of Canada. So the recommendations that we have are very simple. Let's get a committee, a working group, to look at, you know, let's compile some statistics so that we can make policies that will protect the rights of Indigenous women, that will look at the root causes, that sensitize Canadian public, that provide more protection for vulnerable groups in society. Let's look at the UN Declaration that recognizes the rights of Indigenous peoples and our right to protect our children as well, to protect our land, to be able to become self-sufficient, and that, you know, Canada needs a comprehensive national strategy to address violence. So that's some of the recommendations that we have and others in civil society have made to Canada and to the international community. There's the issue of trafficking, and we know that trafficking is a big issue globally. And, you know, I think there is suspicion that a lot of these murdered and missing Aboriginal women have been lost to the trafficking activities. There's also the issue of Aboriginal women in prison and the rights that are being violated within that context. And it goes on and on. We look at we are a peoples. We never surrendered our land. We never surrendered our rights as governments. we talk about nation to nation all the time, but yet that's not how we are treated. And I think that's one thing civil society is seeing and questioning their government is like, what is stopping you from to Canada? What is stopping Canada from actually dealing with Aboriginal people nation to nation? Not this First Nation stuff, which just kind of says, well, you were the First Nations to colonize the Americas, and you came over from Asia through the Bering Strait. Instead of looking at our creation stories, which says we are indigenous to this land, this is something we are not just the caretakers of this land. We have a duty and obligation to protect it and to make sure that future generations get to enjoy its resources. At this point in time, and if we look at climate change, I don't know if that's really possible anymore because of the exploitation of our lands. And I think that's really what's really stopping. The bottom line is economic, and that's why Aboriginal people's rights or Indigenous people's rights around the world are constantly being violated. And that's why Canada, New Zealand, and the U.S. refuse to acknowledge and support the U.N. Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Ellen Gabriel of the Quebec Native Women's Association, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on No One's Legal Radio.
You're very welcome, Jay.